excitable boy, Warren Zevon. You know, you can commit any crime against humanity, any crime in the world, and just claim to be, or it will be excused if you're a guy, as you're just an excitable boy. Adolf Hitler was an excitable boy. Jeffrey Dahmer was an excitable boy. Ted Bundy was an excitable boy. And the list goes on and on and on. And there's a very special reason for that. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm Michael Slate, and we have a special show for you today. In the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Damian Platt, who's one of the authors of Culture is Our Weapon, Making Music and Changing Lives in Rio de Janeiro. It's about the favelas and the group Afro Reggae. But leading the show off is a segment I've been waiting to do for a little while here, and it's on a report issued by the Center for Public Integrity on the culture of indifference. And it's all about sexual assault on college campuses and the need for, you know, a whole different mindset, a whole different game going on. Not a game, but a whole different plan, a whole different way of approach to sexual assault and actually dealing with it in a real sense. And our guest for this is Kristen Lombardi. And Kristen's one of the lead authors of that report. And she's a longtime journalist, has worked as a journalist for more than 12 years, and mainly at alternative news weeklies, and most recently at the Village Voice, where she provided groundbreaking coverage of the 9/11 health crisis. And she's also done a lot of work exploring issues like family courts, criminal justice, and child abuse.
And something that means that there will always be a warm spot in my heart for Kristen. When she wrote for the Phoenix in Boston, she did a lot of work exposing the clergy sexual abuse of children scandal in that city.
Kristen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
You know, the report that you guys did was just an incredible, I mean, very powerful piece, and it's kept me awake since I read it. I mean, it's really been something that you're really chewing on a lot, and I was thinking of a proper way to introduce the show this morning. That's why I came up with Excitable Boy, because it just, your report reeks of that kind of ethos being practiced all throughout the campuses. And I'd like you to explain to people first, what's the report about? What do you mean by the culture of indifference? And you can do it in broad terms to start in terms of what you found.
Okay, but maybe I should step back even a little further to let people know what we did. I mean, about a year ago, myself and my co-reporter, Kristen Jones, at the center, set out to examine how colleges and universities respond to sexual assault cases. And that was kind of the overarching question for our investigation. And over the course of the year, we interviewed 50 college officials who are familiar with the campus judicial process on schools across the country, on college campuses across the country. We interviewed 33 female students who reported to their school administrations being sexually assaulted or raped by fellow students. We surveyed 152 crisis service programs and clinics connected to colleges across the country. And we examined 10 years' worth of complaints and lawsuits filed against schools because of the way they responded to sexual assault complaints, as well as individual records in select cases that we looked at. So the point was to get beyond isolated cases on individual campuses, to connect the dots, to see larger commonalities and trends in the way schools respond to these complaints that might suggest systemic problems or failures. And I think what we found over the course of this year-long investigation has been pretty troubling. The latest series that we released is the series we dubbed A Culture of Indifference. And, I mean, we dubbed that for a reason. And we found that students who have been deemed responsible for sexual assaults on college campuses, which is the equivalent of guilty, right? The term responsible is the equivalent of guilty. It's an institution saying, we believe that these allegations are credible and that an assault did happen. Students who were deemed responsible for sexual assaults often face little or no punishment from school administration, while their victims' lives were frequently turned upside down. As part of our investigation, we reviewed a database of schools maintained by the U.S. Justice Department's Office on Violence Against Women, which is the only database we could find that really was a window into sexual assault proceedings and outcomes on college campuses. And we found that responsible findings rarely lead to tough punishment like expulsion. Our reporting and examination of case records revealed a similar pattern, even in cases involving alleged repeat offenders. So the difference comes in with leniency for students found responsible, as well as a kind of an indifference to the trauma of assault. I mean, the reason we found many student victims end up dropping out of school or transferring altogether is partly because of what they felt were slaps on the wrist for their perpetrators, but also that trauma was compounded by a lack of institutional support, lack of accommodation. Many of these students failed out of their classes and dropped out of school altogether because of the assault. I mean, we found the assault was pretty much something that they very rarely recovered from, and it permanently altered the trajectory of their education. So we looked, I mean, that's why we dubbed it kind of culture of indifference. That was with the college campuses, or, you know, that was on the college campus level, but as also as part of the series we looked at the education department and its enforcement of Title IX. That's a federal law that's meant to protect student victims' right to an education without so-called hostile environment of sexual assault or post-assault harassment. But our findings indicate that the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights rarely investigates student allegations of botched campus sexual assault proceedings and virtually never issues sanctions against institutions. And we reviewed 10 years' worth of completed Education Department investigations and found that the Office for Civil Rights findings of Title IX violations are the exception rather than the rule in cases alleging mishandling of sexual assault proceedings. So the institution, or the federal watchdog, really doesn't seem to be aggressively enforcing Title IX, which is another layer of indifference that we looked at.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Kristen Lombardi, an investigative journalist with the Center for Public Integrity and the lead author of a new study from the center on sexual assault on college campuses and the culture of indifference that seems to be thriving in relation to these assaults.
Let me ask you this, Kristen. In the beginning, when you were talking about what you did you have any idea of the extent of sexual assault on college campuses when you went into this?
No. Just to put it simply, no. I actually came into this story idea as an investigative reporter who's often looked at sexual abuse and institutional indifference or resistance or cover-up to it, right? The clergy abuse scandal in Boston, I was one of the reporters that first exposed the Boston Archdiocese cover-up of a particular pedophile priest there, which really blew that scandal open in that city. And, you know, so I was familiar with the concept of sexual assault and institutional resistance to dealing with it. But I wasn't familiar with campus sexual assault at all. And one of the most surprising things to me when I started early on was this national study, which was funded by the Justice Department, that found that 1 in 5 college women will become the victim of a rape or an attempted rape by the time she graduates. That's a pretty staggering rate of victimization, and it's a Justice Department study that's actually been around for almost a decade. That statistic has never changed or hasn't changed. It's hardly changed at all if you talk to people who study campus sexual assault. And that was really surprising to me. That suggests an incredibly pervasive problem that's really, I think, largely underreported, and not just by victims, but underreported by the media. I mean, it's not covered hardly at all.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think actually part of that same pile of statistics that you're talking about, there was also one that stood out to me too, is that 3% of college women nationally have experienced rape or attempted rape during the academic year. And this means that, for example, a campus with 6,000 co-eds will have an average of 1 rape per day during the school year. Now, you think about that, it's so horrendous, and it's so horrifying and mind-blowing. It's just that scope. That's one of the things that really smacked me in the head, because, you know, you go through it, so, you know, you sort of walk around, and you might have some, I'm not totally naive, you know, you have some understanding of this is a society that pretty much hates women and sanctions all kinds of attacks on women, and so the campuses aren't going to be separate from that. But the scope of it is just incredible, and then you realize how much of it remains unreported even. You know, this is just what we know is reported, but 95% of the attacks are actually unreported.
Yeah. I mean, our investigation yielded 6 stories. In our previous 3-part series, we dubbed A Culture of Secrecy, because it really did look at this problem of underreporting. I mean, we found that students who have been the victim of sexual assault on campus space pretty depressing litany of barriers that either assure their silence or leave them feeling victimized a second time if they do go forward with the report. And part of that series looked at how the majority of students who are sexually assaulted on campus remain silent. You're right, a national study, another Justice Department study, found 95% of victims do not end up reporting the incident either to campus police or campus officials, you know, somebody in a position to actually respond. They may confide in friends, but they're not necessarily filing official reports. And when we interviewed students, I mean, it's pretty clear many victims don't report because they blame themselves, which I think is common to rape victims generally. But what I thought was really interesting about this particular age group, college women who say they were raped, we interviewed students who reported, and those were the 33 I mentioned. We interviewed more students, but some of them never reported, and some of them reported that they were abused by professors, actually, or staff members on campus, not other students. But what I thought was really interesting about all of those students, which was about 50 altogether, is that many of them didn't identify what happened to them as sexual assault for a very, very long time. And I think that's because campus sexual assault is not your stereotypical stranger rape. It often involves people who know each other. At least, you know, they know each other in some way. They attend classes together. They live in the dorms together. You know, they may run in the same social circle of friends. You know, their fraternity and their sorority may, you know, be sister organizations, so to speak. They may be athletes together. You know, they know their alleged perpetrators. And so for a lot of them, they didn't recognize what happened to them as a sexual assault.
Mm-hmm. A quick reminder, we're talking with Kristen Lombardi, the lead author of a new report from the Center for Public Integrity on sexual assault on campuses and the culture of indifference towards it.
You know, one of the things that really stands out to me is that that's one side of the thing. But then this thing that you were talking about in terms of these various federal laws and whatnot, that a lot of the schools just seem to tweak or try to twist or ignore some of these laws or get around it a little bit. And that you actually have some schools that just never report. I was astounded that some schools actually reported zero sexual assaults.
Yes. I mean, that was actually in our first series, Culture of Secrecy. I mean, we looked at the disconnect between, you know, this 1 in 5 statistic and official campus sexual assault statistics. There's a huge discrepancy between official numbers of sexual offenses reported under the Clery Act, which is the federal mandatory campus crime reporting law, and even numbers collected by what I would call your frontline service providers on campus, like campus counseling centers or sexual assault response teams or victim advocacy offices. I mean, one of the things we did very early on when I said we surveyed 152 crisis service programs, we, as part of that survey, collected their data on the numbers of sexual assaults on their campuses, and we compared them to official Clery statistics for those schools, and we found a huge discrepancy in the numbers. I mean, first, like you mentioned, we found 77% of schools, even schools with pretty high student populations, you know, tens of thousands of students, you know, big state university schools, reporting zero sexual offenses. And, you know, it kind of baffles the mind that not one student would have come forward and reported a sexual offense to somebody on that campus. And, you know, we found on top of that there were even a higher percentage that reported really low numbers like ones or twos. And so we looked at the official numbers and we compared them to numbers that we got from, like I said, frontline crisis service programs and clinics on campuses. And we found that there are a large number of loopholes in the Federal Clery Act, loopholes that we believe schools are stretching and exploiting to keep their numbers low. You know, they may not be deliberately not reporting, but they may be taking advantage of some big loopholes in the Clery Act. I mean, the biggest loophole that we found has to do with licensed mental health counselors. And those people on campuses, if you're a licensed mental health therapist or if you're a pastoral counsel, you do not have to report your numbers as part of Cleary, as part of Cleary reporting requirements. Well, we found that schools often just exempt their entire counseling center. Not everybody in the counseling center is a licensed mental health counselor, and so there was a real discrepancy. Some schools who are really proactive and try to live up to the spirit of Cleary Act do collect numbers from their campus counseling centers, and they do it in aggregate form, and they do it in a way that won't reveal or you know, anything having to do with patient confidentiality, you know, the treatment of the patient. But then other schools we found just don't collect numbers at all, or they, from their counseling centers, or they may ask their counseling centers to forward statistics and the counseling centers don't. So right there you have a situation where the one place on campuses where victims are likely to go first, you know, a campus counseling mm-hmm. center, isn't contributing data to the official statistics. So that's one reason why we found, you know, this disconnect.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today to Kristen Lombardi about, from the Center for Public Integrity, about their new study, The Culture of Indifference and Sexual Assault on Campus. It's a culture of indifference, the urgent need for better sexual assault policies and practices on U.S. campuses.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back to continue our conversation with Kristen. All right, that was MIA with Ba Na Na. They used to talk about this in this country. They used to say, go to college, get a good education, get a job. It was always a sham in the first place, although there were times and people that that held true for. But today, think about it. Today, for a young woman, it's go to college, have your head full of dreams, ambition, hopes. Go to college, get an education. Maybe, maybe not, but definitely go to college, and you got a real good chance of getting raped, and nobody will do anything about it.
One of the things that comes through in your report, and it's really, it's just, again, it's just a horror. I keep saying horror because I feel so inadequate in trying to find the word to describe it. You know, there's this dehumanization of women in regard to sexual assault and rape. It's just, everything is part and parcel of robbing the humanity from women. And one of the things that really struck me was the blatant and terrible disregard for the victims that gets expressed in all of this. I mean, there's a couple of things there where you talk. I mean, for one thing, just think about it. You can be expelled from college for plagiarizing a paper, for Christ's sake. I mean, it's a paper. You know, you can be expelled. But people rarely get expelled for sexual assault and rape. You know, you think about that, and then you think about the idea that some of the things that we report in your study about people, these campuses actually proposing mediation as a way of dealing with sexual assault and rape, or treating it as, let's treat this as a teachable moment. That just blew my mind. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, there are two things, and I'll deal first with the issue of seemingly light punishment, because I think it speaks more to this lack of appreciating the trauma of sexual assault and the devastation. You know, the database that I mentioned is maintained by the U.S. Justice Department's Office on Violence Against Women. That office gives campus grants to help colleges and universities improve their response to an adjudication of sexual assault, among other forms of sexual violence, like stalking, for instance, or domestic violence. And like I said, it was the only database we could find on sexual assault proceedings at institutions of higher education nationwide. You know, we wanted to see what happens with the adjudicatory process. And that database includes information on about 130 colleges and universities who received money, federal funding, from the Office on Violence Against Women to improve their response to campus sexual assault from 2003 to 2008. And so these are schools that take the issue seriously. I mean, they're in order to get a grant, you have to prove that there's a problem on your campus that you want to take proactive steps to combat. And yet these schools expelled students only 10 to 25% of the time students found responsible for sexual assault. Only 10 to 25% of the time. So if you flip that around, it's 75 to 90% of the time they meted out more modest penalties, the data showed, such as reprimands, counseling, suspensions, community service, and this whole other category that administrators in interviews we did told us would be educational penalties. They called them educational penalties, like required alcohol treatment or meeting with the campus health educator to learn about what constitutes sexual consent. In the individual cases where we looked at, you know, records of judicial proceedings, we found penalties like orders to write a letter of apology or to write a research paper on sexual violence or to participate in a campus, you know, sexual assault prevention program. Penalties that are educational in nature, which many college administrators will tell you is in keeping with the mission of higher education and the student conduct system generally. And, you know, I think expulsion is so rare because it's so anathema to this educational philosophy among student affairs administrators. You know, they see sexual assault proceedings, sexual assault cases in the broader context of student conduct. You know, which would include the plagiarism case or the cheating case or the vandalism case, right? College disciplinary processes are kicked off when a student is accused of violating the school's conduct code, which is kind of a code of prohibited acts, and sexual assault is included typically in these conduct codes, but also other acts like physical assault, underage drinking in the dorms, you know, plagiarism, cheating are also included. And in those kinds of cases, You might think that this philosophy of finding a teachable moment makes sense. But in sexual assault cases, you know, at least, you know, a lot of people criticize that approach. You know, in other conduct cases, the idea is to educate students found responsible, and that's how administrators and hearing panel members see their job. That's how they see their job in these cases, which is why they would, you know, say, sanction somebody by asking the responsible student to write a research paper on sexual violence, which if you really step back and think about that, it's kind of like, wow. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the most shocking things to me that we found. It's almost offensive when you think about the fact that this is, in the real world, a crime. You know, we found that in a case where a student was found responsible, not just of, you know, sexual assault, which could be inappropriate sexual touching, for instance, but in a case that involved rape allegations. Now, one former university counsel that I spoke with, who consults colleges and universities on their sexual assault policies, said to me, if you want to know why college administrators are so reluctant to expel in these cases, it's because for an educator, expulsion is often seen as a failure on their part to do their job. They wouldn't be doing their job if they expelled a student. And then another student affairs administrator told me that, you know, to college officials, expulsion is like the death penalty in the criminal justice system, meaning it's reserved for the worst of the worst. But a lot of the student victims that we talked to really believe that, you know, rape is the worst of the worst. The vast majority of those 33 female students who reported sexual assault reported rape. You know, they were reported being raped by fellow students. And, you know, to them, that is the worst of the worst.
Well, there's an objective reality to that. I mean, look, you know, you're reducing a woman to a body that is totally objectified and is simply there to allow for the physical servicing of men. You know, and to me, it's just, again, it's tied up with that dehumanizing. And one of the stories that was very moving in your report was it Megan Wright?
Yes.
Yeah, who committed suicide.
Yes.
As a result of this. And to me, that was so, you know, if that doesn't give you a hint of what this dehumanization means, I don't know what does. I mean, and I was reading these statistics shocked. As much as I think that I know this, you know, the fact that 13 times as many rape survivors are more likely to attempt suicide than are people who are not victims of crime. And rape survivors are 6 times more likely to attempt suicide than are victims of other crimes. It tells you something about the to-the-bone nature of this inhuman act, You know, to me, it's just, it's inexcusable what's going on here.
You know, one of the things that struck me the most, college administrators told me that they will kick out someone who's perceived to be a threat to other students on campus. You know, if a student's found responsible for sexual assault, and if that student is perceived to be a threat, not just to the student that he assaulted, and I say he because it's overwhelmingly male and female, but to other female students. In other words, if they think that he's a sexual predator, they'll expel him. But when you talk to administrators, they'll also say that the typical campus sexual assault involves an incident of miscommunication among two drunk students, and the culpable student oftentimes didn't realize or didn't understand that he didn't have consent, and or he didn't realize what constituted assault. Like, he didn't understand that he had committed rape, and he feels bad about it. And so there's your teachable moment. But this attitude really seems to overlook some pretty chilling research that we, you know, came across through our reporting on who actually commits sexual assault on college campuses. That research was conducted by David Lissack, who is a psychology professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston, and he interviewed 2,000 college men and asked them about different acts that would constitute the legal definition of rape or attempted rape. And, you know, a huge number of college men actually admitted to engaging in this kind of activity. And over half of the college students that admitted that, you know, they were student rapists, essentially, were repeat offenders who raped an average of 6 times. And to me, that's like really, really shocking. Mm. You know, a significant number of campus sexual assault can be attributed to repeat offenders. But if the attitude among administrators is these are typically miscommunication, then they're not going to look for signs of predatory behavior.
Mm-hmm. And it becomes, in the final analysis, it all does boil down to wink, wink, nod, nod. You know, it's sort of like chuckle. These are, you know, this is just kids getting it on. No, kids will be kids, and these, you know, the boys will be boys. They're excitable boys. You got to excuse it. And meanwhile, 80% of women who are raped try to physically resist. You think about that. 43%, this thing you're saying, 43% of college-age men conceded to using coercive behavior to have sex, including ignoring a woman's protest, using physical aggression and forcing intercourse, but did not admit it was rape. Those two things together, just, that's it. If you know about this, then you're obliged to stand up and do something about it. Kristen, we have to cut it off now, but thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sure. And have you back in sometime. And the study is The Culture of Indifference. And what's the full title of it?
Well, actually, it's Sexual Assault on College Campuses. Okay. And then, you know, the subtitle is Culture of Indifference.
Okay. And you can get that at the Center for Public Integrity's website, as well as rhrealitycheck.org has a lot of links to it and a lot of commentating on it. And it's an extremely important report. Kristen, thanks a lot again.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Okay, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Kristen Lombardi for the Center for Public Integrity on the study, The Urgent Need for Better Sexual Assault Policies on U.S. Campuses, A Culture of Indifference, Sexual Assault on College Campuses, A Culture of Indifference, from the Center for Public Integrity. We're going to take a short break and be right back with Damian Platt, one of the authors of Culture is Our Weapon, Making Music and Changing Lives in Rio de Janeiro.
Já chegou.
All right. I'm trying to figure out how many of you actually got up and started dancing, or at least moving. And that was, and I'll probably massacre the words, but it's Conflictos Urbanos from Afro Reggae from their album Nova Cara. And joining us to talk about that kind of music and Afro Reggae in particular, but more than that, about his new book that he's one of the co-authors of, and it's Culture is Our Weapon, Making Music and Changing Lives in Rio de Janeiro, is Damian Platt. Damian, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good, good. Well, let's jump into it, man. Were you familiar with that song?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that song. That's my friends Anderson and Dean Elige, who are the vocalists of Afro Reggae. I've been on tour with them a few times, so I've seen them performing that song live, so it brings back very good memories.
Good, good. I really enjoyed it.
Let's start out by giving people an overview of your book.
Okay, it's a book about this group called Afro Reggae, who are a cultural group, who have a band, who are the sort of flagship vehicle who you heard on the song there, who work in Rio's favelas. They've been going for 17 years now, and they work in this complex situation where you've got a city that's ostensibly at peace, but the favelas are controlled by armed groups who fight with each other, who control the communities, who engage in confrontations with the police, and then the police are involved too because there's a high level of corruption. So out of this very complicated and violent situation where you have, unfortunately, thousands of deaths each year, Afro Reggae arose as a group giving voice to young people from these communities, people who didn't want to accept the day-to-day of violence and who are looking for other ways, principally using culture as a way of doing this. And that's what the book talks about. Mm-hmm. It's a book about Rio, but with this main protagonist who is in the form of this group and various people working in it.
Mm-hmm. And we will get more into the group a little bit later in the interview, but I wanted to ask you some other questions about life in the favelas, because one of the things about your book that really struck me is it's a very compelling portrait of what life is like for the masses of people there. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, life in favelas, I think Rio is one of the most famous and beautiful cities in the world, and its favelas are known to be part of that whole city.
Actually, what is a favela for people that don't know?
A favela is a shanty town, or a more pejorative word is a slum, but I don't really like to use that. In fact, I like to use the Brazilian word because there's lots that's positive about them. They're communities that have risen up that over the last 100 or so years that were originally founded by freed slaves and people who had nowhere else to go. And more recently, in over the last 20, 30 years, they've been populated by people who've migrated to the cities from rural areas. And they're very vibrant, very colorful, full of activity and noise. They're not all necessarily very poor. There's lots of business and commerce. They're very thriving places. But at the same time, they live this situation, whereas the rest of the city views them as a threat. And the fact that there are these armed gangs there means that they're constantly associated with violence and negativity, and that's one of the things that Afro Reggae are trying to turn around as well, bringing a positive image and a positive look to these communities, because they're, in many ways, they're great places to be.
Well, it's very interesting, because when you talk about the people who come into the communities, coming from the Northeast or coming from other parts of Brazil and looking for work or trying to find ways, but you also talk about how these communities themselves are oftentimes illegal, and then what happens is that the people inside the communities are actually sort of concentrate a certain amount of, I think you said, race, ethnicity, and class, and it becomes sort of the dangerous residents of Brazil, the dangerous citizens of Brazil, and it's the people who are sort of shunted aside and left outside of society. It's akin to what I've seen in many parts of the world in terms of the shanty towns in South Africa, but other places too, where a whole section of people, including actually even here, where the inner cities here, have a whole section of youth that are just have no future because the system can't use them.
Sure, I mean, I think every society has its other, you know, that other group of people, the outsiders. And what's particularly interesting in Rio is that they are the other, but on the other hand, they're people who've contributed hugely to the cultural and economic growth of the city. I mean, of course, because the low wages of labor are there, and they're the people who build the city, who work in construction, who work in all the service jobs. And one of the only reasons they can survive is because they're living in these informal communities. So people always say, oh, the favelas are frightening, I'm never going to a favela, but middle-class people from the city will usually have someone who lives in a favela working in their house. So there's this funny symbiotic relationship, whereas they are feared, but at the same time, without them, the city wouldn't operate. And I guess that repeats itself in other countries throughout the world as well. But in Rio, it's very visible because it's a city where everyone's living on top of each other, and so it's always in your face as well.
That was one of the things that struck me in your book when you were talking about being in this very expensive apartment building or condo building or whatever, and it was just like it was a high rise, and that for all that you're paying and all that you're supposed to be sheltered from everything bad that exists in Rio, then you look out the window and the favela is right across the street from your balcony or whatever. It really emphasized the thing of people live on top of one another, and the contradictions in the society are very jarring and very sharp, it would appear.
Yeah. That's right. They have a saying in Rio called, what they say about being in Rio, they say, juntos y misturados, that means together and mixed up, which is a bit the way that cariocas, who are people from Rio, live. But at the same time, the violence in the favelas and the violent relationship the police has, and very often corrupt police, with the gangs and with the people who live there, has got to a stage where it can't be ignored anymore. I mean, we're talking about thousands of deaths every year. We're talking about whole communities controlled by gangs with guns who make the rules, so there's no rule of law in these communities. And I think that I hope this book will help people to think and help people to learn about and how Rio actually operates, especially as it's going to be a city that's going to host the Soccer World Cup in 2014 and then the Olympic Games in 2016.
You know, first let me remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Damian Platt, who's one of the co-authors of Culture is Our Weapon, Making Music and Changing Lives in Rio de Janeiro. It's a book that's just come out from Penguin Books, and it's a very interesting book, very compelling portrait of life in Brazil, and it focuses a lot on the Afro-Reggae group, and we'll get into that in shortly. But, Damian, you mentioned in the book, there's a statistic you mentioned, and you referred to this sort of generally before. You say, early in the book, you talk about this is a book about war as much as a book about anything else, and you say it's a war zone in the favelas on a daily basis. And the simple statistic that may illuminate the level of violence, between 1948 and 1999, an estimated 13,000 people were killed in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Between 1979 and 2000, more than 48,000 died from firearm-related injuries in the city of Rio. That is astounding.
Yeah, it is astounding. And when you live in Rio in the day-to-day, and when you work in favelas, and when you come and go, you see how it happens because of just the huge quantity of arms and guns that the community is literally awash with them. It's common for the gangs. In most favelas, they'll have an armed presence on the street. So you have kids going to school, parents doing the shopping, people coming and going, and around them you'll have kids carrying automatic pistols, AK-47 sometimes, the AR-15 rifles. You'll see all these weapons on the street. And when you see how the police come into the communities, which I've seen very often myself because it's a daily occurrence, they shoot first. So the first thing you know, there is police. You hear bullets, or you might hear a firework go off, which is the gang announcing that the police are there. Very often before you hear that, you'll hear bullets, and mm-hmm. That's it. You have to run for cover.
Well, let's talk about the police in the favelas, because that seems to be a very, not only is it a fact of daily life, but it seems to be a very heavy weight coming down on the masses of people in the favelas.
It is. If you live inside a favela, the police will view you as a potential suspect regardless, and you're criminalized by coming to a community that's controlled by that group. And it's so bad that because there are different favelas that are controlled by rival groups, you can't, if you're, say, from a favela like Rocinha, you can't go to parts of a huge area called Complexo da Maré because they're controlled by another group. And it's not just the police who you run a risk of getting in trouble with, it's the gang as well. But I think the police attitude to favela residents is an endorsement of the way Brazilian society and Rio society, the attitude it has towards people living in the favelas, that they're all potentially criminal. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of gives a license to the police to go in and do what they want. And in the very worst cases, you have an incident like the Vigário Geral killings, which led to the formation of Afro-Reggae, when 21 innocent people were machine gunned, literally, by a group of rogue police. It's not all police, but there are enough of them to have a serious impact on the dynamics of the whole conflict.
Well, a lot of times, too, what you seem to document, too, in the book is a lot of times the police actually have a symbiotic relationship with the various gangs, the various gang factions.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a policeman in Rio, a military police on the street, you're earning a very low salary. You're probably like one social step above the people in the favela themselves. So you yourself are fragile, you're badly trained, you're not given the resources you need to do your job properly. So it's normal if you have to coexist in a situation where there are guys who are better armed than you and have more money than you, and who offer you a certain amount of money each week to leave them alone. I think you or I know which option we'd probably take, because you want to look after your own safety and you've got a family to look after as well. So it's not about the individual police, it's about a system that tolerates and incentivates that by refusing to train the police properly, by not allowing them proper salaries, by not looking long term, and by having accepted corruption as just a way of doing things. So we really need long term reform of the police to change things in Rio.
Well, I'll tell you, that is a place where you and I might have a little bit of a difference, because to me, it's actually the police are actually, even they're working with the gangs. It's, you look at the social role of the police, it really is. This thing you were saying about the reason they view all the people in the favelas as immediately suspects is because their role is to keep people in the position they're in, you know, and control them.
I agree. But I think that the police are just agents of a larger system.
I agree with that.
Society wants them to do. But yes, the role of the police and the drug traffic, because the drug traffic, the presence of the drug traffic, you have a community like Rocinha, which has 150,000 people in it. The presence of the drug traffic, the fact that they make the rules, the fact that they decide who gets ahead or not within the community, means that the community as well can't develop politically.
Well, let's...
It's not just the police. The drug traffic are a de facto oppressive force. Mm-hmm.
A quick reminder. We're talking with Damian Platt, one of the co-authors of a new book from Penguin Books, Culture is Our Weapon, Making Music and Changing Lives in Rio de Janeiro. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. Welcome back. That was another taste of the musical work of Afro Reggae. We just heard a little bit of Aguas de Moloch by Afro Reggae, and it was from their album Favela Uprising.
Let's jump into the music part of this now, because that was actually, at least for a minute here, I wanted to talk to you about some of the, you know, the parties that existed, the dances, the role that this all plays in people's life, funk, which actually was really intriguing to me, funk and prohibited funk, which I thought was actually had a lot to, you know, you look at that in the sense of, even when I was trying to draw parallels with like sort of the gangster rap in the U.S. or whatever, but the whole idea that you had prohibited funk and you make a comment in the book, or somebody, one of the characters in your book makes the comment that funk isn't just music, it's a way of life. Can we talk about the role of music in the favelas?
Yeah, I mean, music as a cultural expression in Brazil's favelas goes right back to the roots of samba. And more recently, funk has become the musical expression that's most popular. You can't go to a party, you can't go a walk around without hearing a funk music, which is derived from 80s US black soul music, with its roots in people like James Brown, and then the arrival of electro and electronic music at the end of the 80s, combined with hip-hop. So resources like Kraftwerk, Planet Rock by Afrika Bambaataa is also a track that was very popular at the beginning, and it's molded into a Brazilian electronic music form that's got a very big bass, and they have huge parties, and if the favela is controlled by a gang on a Saturday night, that gang will put on the funk party, which is because it's free, all the young people from the community go, and because the gang will put it on, they will play music that sympathizes with them. They might have a DJ, they have their preferred MCs. And traditionally, the MCs will sing about the gangsters, will say that this gang is better, will sing about guns. You might have guns on display, so it becomes this sort of ritual promotion and celebration of gang culture, which the effect it has on the kids and the people participating, you can't really calculate it, but it sort of involves them all in this process.
Now, let me ask you this, because Afro Reggae then comes into this and actually sees the value and the role of music and art and culture in people's lives. And as far as I understand, you have the major band, Afro Reggae, then you have, sub bands, and then you have sub bands, and then you've also expanded into things like theater and circus too?
Yeah, but the organization actually now has 5 different cultural centers, which are permanent buildings inside different favelas in the city. They work with the core disciplines of music, principally percussion, then theater, circus, and dance, and then also they will have computer centers, access to other forms of education. They have social teams in each of the cultural centers, so it's a place where young people can congregate, can learn a skill, can make friends, and can have access to social workers and psychologists who will give them support, who will try and make sure they stay in school and so on. And at the same time, they will, they're producing culture. They're learning a skill, and then when they get to a level where they're competent enough, they'll be producing culture. And that's where Afro Reggae has professional bands, which are contracted. They have young people who have gone in as pupils and then become professional instructors who have been contracted in Brazil. And in fact, they'll go to other places. There's a group who regularly go to the UK and teach young people there. So it's about taking the talent and the potential of these young people and turning it into something positive rather than something negative, which is the lure of the guns and the crime and the prohibited funk and so on.
Let me remind people that I'm Michael Slate, and this is The Michael Slate Show. And today I'm talking with Damian Platt, one of the co-authors of Culture is Our Weapon, Making Music and Changing Lives in Rio de Janeiro. And it has to do with Afro Reggae and the favelas in Rio. And Damian, one of the questions, and this is something I'm going to preface this with, as much as I enjoyed and found really eye-opening and really learned a lot in most of the book, in a lot of all of the book, really, but one thing that really kind of got to me was that on one level, there's this importance of celebrating the culture and trying to bring people hope and dreams. But then there's the whole other side of things where the way that seems to be posed is the entrepreneurial side of things. And to me, that was kind of problematic. I think you have the character, the man Junior, who is, I guess, one of the leaders of Afro Reggae.
And one of the founders.
Yes. And he makes a comment where he says, this is a capitalist world and we have to survive. And in that, it seems that there's a certain acceptance of the way things are on a very basic level. And, you can see to me, there's a danger in that because it goes from really bringing this culture and music and alive and the hope and dreams to then he argues for forming things like partnerships, which go from, one that really did really horrify me was, the attempt to make partnerships with the police. But then the other was partnerships with the Ford Motor Company or big oil companies or iron ore companies, which are part of the very same system we were talking about earlier that actually is responsible for all this in the first place. How do you look at that? How do you explain that? I mean, it really seems to be
perpetuating and in some senses even perpetrating more of the same in one form or another, even if it's completely unintended.
You get confined by the borders that are set up by the system.
Yeah, that is an interesting point, and I think it's hard to answer in a short answer. But I'd say, firstly, there's no need to be horrified about Afro Reggae saying they'll work with the police. It's extremely important that they work with the police because they have a direct tactic of working with the drug traffickers and getting people who work out of the drug business and who are armed and who engage in confrontations with the police. So as much as they're working with them, it's perfectly legitimate and important that they should work with the police as well because, as I said, the police themselves are victims of a larger situation. The traffickers are just doing a job to get money, and in their way, so are the police. So I think that sort of partnership is legitimate and important. In terms of businesses, that's Junior's own personal philosophy, and it's the way he has chosen to help Afro Reggae grow, because as much as he looks to achieve self-sustainability, it's an organization that's grown. They have installations. They have cultural centers. In order to be able to continue that work, they need partnerships and they need supporters, because money doesn't fall from the sky. So his way of doing that is say, yes, I will make partnerships with business. I don't think he's claiming that he's going to overturn a system on his own. I think he's saying, and Afro Reggae are saying, we're here, we have a voice, we're trying to change our individual situations. We hope that other people will be inspired by what we do to take their situation into their hands. But at the same time, they are an institution that has needs, that has financial requirements and has to be pragmatic to survive. So I guess it's really a matter of how you see it, whether you see that business is necessarily part of the oppressive system always, or by whether working with those businesses, you can work together to try and change the system.
Well, that's that. Yeah, I mean, and that's part of the. To me, that's actually part. I mean, I would again, we would. And another day, another show, we can have a big argument about the police, because I really think that the police are, you know, the police are, there is nothing redeeming, or no amount of understanding. If you, once you cross that line into being a cop, you cross a line that says you are the enemy of the people. That's basic in my thinking.
Hard line. How are you going to have a society with no police?
Well, I think actually, you know what, I think the bigger question is, how do you, in this society, you have to look at what role the police play, and I think the police would have to play a very different role in a different kind of society. And to me...
Well, that's right, but I think that's what, by working with the police, that's what Afro Reggae is trying to do, is trying to look, question their role and change their role.
Right, but see, here's the question. To me, there's actually the point of, and again, this comes down to, it's not a matter of sort of some sort of moral purity, but there's actually a question of how, you know, these companies, these corporations, and I've seen it many times, at best what they end up doing is they're getting some PR, or they're building up a section of people who would be supportive or be more stable in relation to what their system overall is doing, because these people have been responsible for the most massive and pervasive and inhuman exploitation of the people in Brazil and all over the world for a long time. And so to me, it's a question of what are we working to perpetrate and perpetuate. And whether, and so a lot of times it's not, you know, it happens even as we're trying to, because we're stuck in those parameters. And if you don't see the possibility, or you don't understand the way things work and the interconnections, then you're stuck thinking that this is permanent and this is all we do. Or, as Junior said, it's a capitalist world and all we can do is try to find a way to survive. In my thinking, and this is one of the things I wanted to ask, and it'll be the last question actually, which in about 2 minutes, does Afro Reggae also have any revolutionary elements within it?
I think they're revolutionary in the way they try and turn things on their head, in the way they see the potential of someone else who society would discard, such as a drug trafficker or a killer, you know, someone who has reached the bottom of the well and everyone else has given up on. I think that's quite revolutionary. I think for them to go and work with the police in such a situation where there's so much hate and mistrust was also revolutionary. So I think they have an attitude in saying, we'll work with that situation no one else will work with. But obviously, as an institution that has grown over time and responsibilities have grown and has needs for funding, it's harder to be revolutionary all the time.
All right, Damien, I want to thank you for joining us, and we'll come back and wrestle over some of these questions we were wrestling with. But thank you very much for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much, Michael.
All right. Thank you, Damien. We've been talking with Damien Platt, one of the co-authors of Culture is Our Weapon, Making Music and Changing Lives in Rio de Janeiro. I'm Michael Slate, and this is The Michael Slate Show. And going out, I just want to remind people, you know, I always talk about the world cries out for revolution. Well, you know what? Bob Avakian recently has been doing a lot of work around this point about the terrible weight on the masses of people. And one of those things is not understanding the connections of how things work, the inner workings, and in that, you end up having a belief that there's somehow what we have today is permanent. The social conditions or relations are permanent features of the human condition. And this is indeed a terrible weight, but it's one that can be and really has to be broken through on if humanity is going to survive. You want to write to me? You can at michaelslate@redfuture.com, michaelslate@redfuture.com. I want to thank my engineer, Melissa Figueroa.
I want to thank Age and Henry Carson for their production assistance. And most of all, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in.
So I'll talk to you again next week. We're going out with Communist Moon from International Noise Conspiracy.